Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Cache Valley ENT and the Allergy Clinic, with providers Dr. Wood, Benyon, and Blotter, and PA Lindsay Humes, practicing ear, nose, and throat medicine, allergy services, and facial, plastic, and reconstructive surgery. 753-7880.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn. It is nearing the best time of year to tour Utah's national parks. Today on the program, we hear from your potential tour guide.
My name is Mark Deschewitz, and I'm a geologist, and currently I work with my wife for Dixie University, a small arm of Dixie University, which is called Dixie Rhodes Scholar. And what we do is we take people out on big tour buses with a driver, and we do educational tours of the national parks and state parks as well, of Utah, Nevada, and portions of Arizona.
Before giving guided tours, Deschewitz worked in the fossil fuel industry, coal and oil. His background gives him a unique perspective on the geology of the parks. In addition, touring the parks offered him a new beginning.
I worked for Shell and actually Amoco Production Company when it was Amoco before it got bought out by BP. And I worked in the oil industry for about 30 years and a little over a year in the coal industry many years ago. And after I reached my pain point at Shell, which was about three decades, we decided we needed a change. And this is after we were actually in New Orleans for Hurricane Katrina. So we evacuated for Katrina, moved over to Houston, and after about 3.5-4 years or so of living with 5.5 million other people, we decided we needed to move closer to family and in an inspiring place, which we found here just west of St. George. And how do we wind up with Rhodes Scholar? Well, we were registering to vote in Ancestor Square, and there happened to be a gentleman there who was taking the registration forms, and he worked for Rhodes Scholar. We struck up a conversation. So within 2 weeks of being in St. George, we landed a job, which was a good thing because it was in the middle of the Great Recession. So we actually needed it. So it came at the right time for us.
In college, Deschewitz started out studying business, which he says he didn't like. So he switched to geology and was instantly hooked.
I'd always had an interest in science, and I took a minor segue into the business world, and I hated it, so wound up with geology, and that's it. Found what I love to do.
He and his wife live near one of the most interesting areas, geologically speaking, in the state, Silver Reef in Washington County. When silver was discovered there in the late 1800s, Silver Reef turned into a booming, rowdy mining town about a mile north of Leeds. Now it is more appreciated for its geologic history.
Silver Reef is an amazing spot on the planet. It's a very, very special place because when you go to Silver Reef, you can look at about 90 million years of tectonic history where the Farallon or Pacific Plate was slamming into the western side of the U.S., and you see the product of that, and the product of that is the Virgin Anticline, which Silver Reef occupies the western flank of it. And then about 25 million years ago, the Pacific Plate started to pull away, and it started to extend the crust throughout this area. And when it did that, you created the Hurricane Fault, and you started the initiation of some of the igneous activity. The Pine Valley Mountains came up. And then all of the subsequent igneous activity is related to the extensional forces in here and creation of the Basin and Range in Nevada, of course, the most mountainous state in the Union, which is pretty cool. And that's all due to the extension. So you can stand by the museum, the Wells Fargo Museum in Leeds, and you can look out and you can see the Colorado Plateau. If you're facing north, you can see the Colorado Plateau to your right, which is just a beautiful sight. You can see Zion National Park from that vantage point. And if you look to the left, you can see the Pine Valley Mountains, which is a very special feature in itself because it's the largest type of igneous feature that we know of in the world, just north of St. George, just west of Leeds.
Igneous comes from the Latin word meaning fire.
So they are rocks that form from melted crust, melted portions of the crust that come up onto the surface or are intruded into the rocks below the surface. If they're intruded into the surface, they're called intrusive igneous rocks. If they're extruded onto the surface, they're called extrusive igneous rocks. Pretty simple. It's easy for geologists to remember that way. The history of this area is a long one. There are two types of history. There's the tectonic history that made the structures out here, and then there's something called the depositional history. That's how the rocks were actually laid down. And a lot of, you know, you can go back about 250 million years ago to the top of the Grand Canyon sequence, and what you see are consecutive layers of sea level rises and falls. Sea level coming in, depositing marine strata, and sea level going out, depositing more terrestrial type sediments. And what you see when you look out from that particular horizon, from the top of the Grand Canyon sequence up, is a marvelous history book. And each one of those formations is like a chapter in Earth history. There may be a marine chapter. There could be a tidal flat chapter. There could be a river and floodplain chapter. And each one of these layers is just stacked on top of one another. And after all those layers were laid down, they were uplifted and eroded and intruded by igneous material, all due to the tectonic history. So it's got a pretty long depositional history going back to the bottom of the Grand Canyon sequence, all the way up to the Eocene, which is where Bryce Canyon sits at the very top of the Grand Staircase. So you've got a lot of Earth history just in the area from the top of the Grand Canyon sequence to Bryce Canyon. If you're at the north rim of the Grand Canyon or at the Lefevre Overlook near the north rim looking north, you're standing on 270 million-year-old rocks looking out into the distance about 65 miles at the top of the Grand Staircase. You've got 35 million-year-old rocks. So you've got about 230 or so million years of geologic history just in that that short time span, that short distance.
Zion National Park, on top of the Colorado Plateau, is another chapter in the region's geology noted by Desiewicz. The Colorado Plateau started to uplift due to processes geologists are now just beginning to understand due to a project called the US Array,
which is developing deep-seated images, 3D images below the surface, deep into the crust and mantle. So we're starting to understand how the Colorado Plateau uplifted. And what you see in Zion are a series of canyons, and all these canyons are related to faulting and fracturing that are due to both extension and uplift of the Colorado Plateau. So anytime you see a canyon or a slot canyon or a large canyon, it's due to either fracturing or faulting. And if you think about it, think about if you took an onion and you cut it in half on your cutting board in one direction, and you kind of laid out those slices onto the cutting board. And then you took the other half and you kind of diced it up and you put that in a pile on the cutting board and you tilted the cutting board and you ran water over it. The stuff that's sliced and diced, okay, would wash off of that cutting board faster, right, because there's more surface area for the water to drag the material down the cutting board. Well, the same thing happens in canyons. The water, the fracturing actually creates an area for water to flow in. It creates an area for soil to form in, for plants to grow in. Trees grow in those fractures, there's root rotting, there's freeze-thaw action in those fractures, and those fractures become slot canyons, and slot canyons become grand, much larger. And that's how Zion Canyon came to be, from a little slot canyon that eventually got eroded away by the Virgin River.
Next, he covers Capitol Reef.
It's kind of like the Leeds area, really. The Leeds area has the Pine Valley laccolith to the west of it. And the Virgin Anticline sits we're sitting on the west flank of the Virgin Anticline. Well, in Capitol Reef, you've got the Water Pocket Fold, which is a very large compressional feature formed the same way in the same time that the Virgin Anticline formed. And you also have the Henry Mountains right there, too, which is another laccolith, which formed almost at the same time as the Pine Valley Mountains. So it's just a little bit different environment. You're not in the Mojave Desert, just at the north end of the Mojave Desert. A little bit more water there and a little bit higher elevation and some beautiful, beautiful scenery out there.
The Pine Valley Mountains, the Henry Mountains, the Las Salles and Navajo Mountain all have something in common. They're all laccoliths.
What they really are, it's kind of like a volcano wannabe. The igneous material, the liquid molten material came up, tried to make it to the surface, but it couldn't make it to the surface. So it kind of found a layer that was weak, and it injected along that horizontal layer, and it kind of bowed up all the formations on top of it. And it happened several times. It kind of injected its way in and just kind of bowed the surface up. And then when it bowed that surface up, all that material got eroded away, exposing all of the igneous material that was really an intrusive igneous rock. And now it's exposed to the surface for all of us to see today.
Switching gears, Desiewicz discusses the geology of oil. I asked him to define it and talk about why we have so much of it.
That's a tough one to answer. Oil is a hydrocarbon. It's made up of hydrogen and carbon atoms, and it's a very energy-dense fuel. And it forms from zooplankton and phytoplankton, animal and plant plankton, that was floating in a water column, growing in the photic zone. And special conditions had to be present in order to preserve that organic matter. So imagine a body of water. So you've got this basin, okay, just like a basin that you find out in your garage, just a tub. And at the bottom of that tub, this organic matter is raining down, dying and raining down to the bottom. And when it gets down to the bottom, it starts to decay. And if the basin's deep enough, it has just a certain amount of oxygen in that bottom layer. And through the years of success, all this material, organic matter, raining down, it uses up all the oxygen at that bottom layer. So you get a layer down there called an anoxic zone or oxygen-free zone. So as that material continues to rain down, now it goes into an oxygen minimum zone or anoxic zone, and it gets preserved. Over hundreds of thousands, millions of years, that material gathers into a very thick layer of organic matter. And as it gets buried deeper and deeper and gets subjected to more heat and pressure, it becomes something called a sapropel or a kerogen, then sapropel. And then eventually that material is actually like an organic oily ooze that's in this rock. It gets buried deep enough, and eventually what happens is it gets expelled once it hits a certain depth or temperature. When it does that, it's trying to find a place to go. And it may go up a fault, it might go up a fracture, it might travel for long distances and get into a rock that's called a reservoir. So just like water is held in a reservoir in the subsurface, oil can also penetrate a reservoir in the subsurface. But in order for that to actually be contained, you need a trap. So you've got a source rock, and you've got a migration pathway, and then you need to trap it somehow. And there are a whole host of different types of traps that can form, one of which is an anticline, similar to the Virgin anticline and the water pocket fold and all of these, and the Kaibab uplift. Those are all wonderfully exposed anticlines at the surface. So that's a trap. And if you think about, if you ever use good seasoned salad dressing, and you kind of mix it up, and you've got oil and vinegar in there, right? What happens to the oil if you just let it set over time? It floats to the top because it's less dense. So imagine a sandstone layer that's kind of folded into a dome, and it's got a very impermeable layer on top of that sandstone. So you've got porous and permeable with an impermeable seal on top of it. And this oil comes in to a water-rich layer. It displaces the water because it's less dense, it floats up to the top, so you actually get a layer of reservoir with oil, with water down below it. So that's a typical type of trap, and that was one of the first types of traps that was discovered by Colonel Drake in Pennsylvania back in the mid-1800s. They looked for surface anticlines similar to what we see on the surface of Utah today. But that's a simplified version of what's needed. So you need reservoir, you need trap, you need source rock, and you need to bury it deep enough to expel it. And the fourth or fifth item is that you need the trap to be in place at the time of expulsion of the oil. So the timing has to be just right for that to happen.
Bringing it to the surface is more complicated than you might think.
The bottom line with regard to oil and gas exploration is that a lot of things have to work. And most people, and understandably so, really don't have a feel for this. But that, you know, most wildcat wells that are drilled by oil companies have about a 75% risk of failure. In an offshore setting where rig rates can cost over $1 million a day and it takes 150 days to drill a well, that's a high-risk venture. So in order for things to work, everything has to come together in a very succinct fashion.
It's really our Earth's history, and I think oftentimes it's overlooked, what it's made of and how precious it is.
It is. Every time we turn on a light or start the engines in our car, we're actually, when you think about it, we're burning solar energy. We're using solar energy that was captured in organisms 65, in some cases 65 million years ago, in some cases 190 million years ago. So we're taking solar energy that was captured in organisms that were buried and preserved and now reclaimed in the form of oil and refined to gasoline, or in coal, for instance, another thing that gets burned. That's just, you know, destroying solar energy from hundreds of millions of years ago in some cases. Yeah, pretty precious stuff.
It is hard to imagine the expanse of the Earth's history and all it contains in the geology that we can see.
We're talking about a 4.6 billion year Earth, and we're just talking about a very short time period, you know, at the very top of the crust that we're looking at. So it has a very long history, and we're just trying to, we're just able to look at a very small portion of it because it's uplifted in those folds. So we can see it, you know, a little bit easier, right? And we can kind of walk down the middle of those folds because they're all eroded away. But yeah, you know, it's a long, long history. And, you know, our lifespan is just the blink of an eye in geologic time. And it's hard for people to just get a handle on that. My wife likes it because she'll always be very young, because I think in terms of, you know, millions of years. So, you know, she just says, you know, it's great being married to a geologist because my age is nothing to them. So even if you strip away all the ages, you know, I always tell people, you know, it really doesn't matter how old you, what label you put on the Earth. And I've had people that truly believe that the Earth was 5,000 years old on some of our excursions, and students over the years. And, you know, it's kind of a, it comes down to, you know, you don't want to interfere with people's belief systems. You know, I think that if you're passionate, if people are passionate about what they believe, I think that's wonderful. And I'm certainly not going to interfere with that. So what I usually tell people, you know, is that go out there and enjoy the beauty and put as many zeros on the end of whatever age you think it is, you know, and it really doesn't matter. The only thing that I always tell people is that, you know, when you remember when your mama used to make you pancakes in the morning, you know, the oldest pancake was on the bottom. And the youngest pancake was on the top. And that's really all you have to remember. So if you think the Earth is 5,000 years old, then bust it up into, you know, 10-year increments. If you think it's 4.6 billion, then we have a different sequence. You know, that's all.
Mark Desiewicz will be presenting two upcoming talks: The Geology of Silver Reef at the Friends of Gold Butte in Mesquite, Nevada on March 19 at 7 p.m., and another titled Light Pollution and Preserving Our Night Sky on April 2nd at the Canyon Community Center in Springdale, Utah. Thank you for listening. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah.
Hi, this is Blair Larson, host of Fresh Folk. On the show this week, I featured the distinctive voice of Will Kimbrough and the debut release from the 20-year-old Parker Millsap. I'll also play tracks from new albums by David Crosby, the John Butler Trio, and Patty Griffin, among other talented artists. Join me this Saturday at 8 p.m. for Fresh Folk on Utah Public Radio.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Open Monday through Saturday until 3, offering lunch items including veggie burgers with a lemon garlic aioli or lentil salad with tarragon vinaigrette. Support also comes from the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra, presenting Brahms' Ein Deutsches Requiem, Opus 45, a message of peace, hope, and consolation, Friday, March 28th at 7:30 in the Ellen Eccles Theater. Information at AmericanFestivalChorus.org or 435-752-0026.
Driving down the road this morning, I'm feeling a sense of freedom.
Welcome to Science Questions. This is Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery.
How I traveled so far, I had my share of bad luck. It only made me strong.
Covelo is a small mountain town located in Round Valley, Northern California, with a population of about 3,000 people. Driving into the valley, it looks much like entering Cache Valley, Utah, from the mouth of Sardine Canyon. Agricultural fields line the highway, and forested mountains border the lush valley. Only Round Valley is surrounded by the Eel River and the Mendocino National Forest.
The Yaqui were the first inhabitants of Round Valley, and in the late 1800s, six different tribes were forced into the newly established Yaqui Indian Reservation. The Yaqui, in turn, were forced to share their ancestral homeland with strangers and enemies, and fighting ensued. After years of intermarriage and land sharing, they banded together and formed a new tribe in 1936 called the Round Valley Indian Tribe, a sovereign nation of confederated tribes. It's the largest Indian reservation in California. Today, the town of Covelo is a community of farmers. In Chapter 1 of our series Farm Action, we profile the 30-year-old horse-powered CSA farm, Live Power, founded by Steve and Gloria Decatur. It is one of the first community-supported agricultural farms in the U.S. to use biodynamic practices, which means they apply a spiritual, ethical, ecological approach to agriculture. Sherry joined them for an early morning harvest in August.
I mean, these are just beautiful.
Yeah, that one's called Beatrice, and it's a really wonderful purple, lavender, purple, kind of violet.
This is Stephen. He is describing one of the eggplant varieties he is harvesting.
Shaded, darker in some areas and lighter in others. And yeah, it's quite beautiful. It's a little bit of a shy producer, but it's worth it because it's really beautiful and it, I think, tastes pretty good too. So.
Hey, good morning.
I never see Keegan smile that big in the morning.
Sylvia is one of seven apprentices at the farm. Each year, 4 to 7 apprentices come here from across the nation and the world to learn how to develop their own small-scale organic farms.
I'm picking parsley, and I'm picking it from the outside in so the inside can keep growing. And I'm not counting, though I should be. I'll count later. And I'm picking off the yellow leaves and throwing them in the path. We're going to give them to the cows.
And how many do you have to pick?
500 and something, depending on how many members we have today. So it's like 5 per share.
Live Power Farm supports 200 members or households in San Francisco and Mendocino counties. Once a week, they receive an overflowing basket of fresh organic vegetables, which feeds upwards of 600 people from just 40 acres.
I'm kind of like the go-to greens person. Everyone else has a thing that they harvest every day. Like Amy does carrots, and Keegan does eggplant, Alex does basil. I had kale, but then we stopped having kale, so now I have any other green that comes up.
It smells so good.
Carrots are also a little bit of a hassle. They all have their own milk works. At least the way we do it here, you know. Because, like, we're just harvesting it for the CSA.
We are standing in the 4-acre garden among raised beds and row crops filled with eggplants, corn, melons, peppers, tomatoes, and more. Much more. Stephen has the spacing of each plant and row perfected to maximize healthy growth and productivity. The seeds were started from their homemade soil with the help of 6 draft horses, and they generate their own garden fertility with their compost and cover crops. They also produce their own hay and grain and use intensive rotational grazing for their horses, cattle, and sheep. A flock of chickens, a dairy cow, and feeder pigs complete the farm organism.
We grow what there's like 8 probably or more different varieties of eggplant in these 4 beds. And everything from the early Japanese slender, long ones to these globe type and Italian types. It's just, you know, our goal being 100% community-based farm. We don't go to markets with produce at all. We work directly with a community of about 200 households that we're feeding, and we're trying to grow the vegetable supply for those people, and we want it to have diversity, and we want to spread any given crop over as long of a season as it's possible to grow that crop over, so that we can keep having a good diversity in the baskets that people get.
How many do you have to harvest today?
5. We're trying to get 4 per share.
This is Sarah, the garden manager, harvesting this week's corn crop.
We just about have it, but we're trying to get about 50 more. Keegan, do you have your number?
41.
Okay, cool.
Why did you get into this field?
Well, I had been farming in Colorado and Nebraska and had heard about this place from people out there who were surprised that I didn't know about it, seeing as though I grew up in the Bay Area. And this is one of the first CSAs in California, and they use draft horses, and I had been working on biodynamic farms as well. So the folks that told me about this place, that's why they were surprised I didn't know about it, because there are not many CSA farms that use draft horses, in California at least, biodynamic CSA farms that use draft horses. So I came back for Thanksgiving to visit family and drove up from the Bay that weekend to help Steve and Gloria with their final harvest, and really enjoyed myself and got along well with Steve and Gloria kind of right off the bat. So, and this is a gorgeous valley. Similar enough to where I grew up, or at least familiar in certain ways, but also a lot more wild and open and peaceful and calm. And so I was definitely attracted to the beauty of this farm and of this valley and of the people who work here. And I was looking also for a place that had some traditions already set and a more formal apprenticeship program, and that's what I found here, and it's been great.
What inspires you about this work and this philosophy, and what's the value in it that you see and hope to show others?
Well, I guess what really draws me to farming, a lot of things draw me to farming, but why I know this is something that I want to do for the rest of my life, and what continues to inspire me, is that I will never fully understand how plants grow and how every ecosystem works. There's something really amazing and intriguing and enigmatic about it, and the fact that I'll be learning for the rest of my life is really exciting. And I also, just at a very basic level, love growing food for people. Mm-hmm. So I feel like
being a farmer and doing it in a responsible way brings a lot of light into the world. And we're living in a time when it's difficult to determine how your actions affect things, you know, in a positive and a negative way, whether or not you're contributing to some greater good, or there's a lot of kind of overwhelming things happening right now. So farming is very grounding and it's very real. And at the end of the day, if you're trying your best to be responsible about it, you know, then I feel like I'm doing something positive and there is light that I'm bringing into the world. So that's what inspires me. And I work with some amazing people, so that's inspiring as well.
Now the melons are starting to ripen, so that's the next kind of big harvest that we're headed into. But everything else is still, all the summer crops are still producing pretty heavily. We had lots of cucumbers and summer squash last week. Actually filled the cargo van almost so full that I was going to wonder where to put the boxes. And that went all to San Francisco.
That must be a good feeling.
Yeah, it is good. Always exciting to have a really bountiful harvest, you know, and to get to this time of year, which is the harvest time. In the early spring, you don't have anything really, and you're just starting planting your crops in March and getting things in the ground, and a lot of work to get everything going so that then you are going to have a crop, and then the early spring crops come in. But then you've got to start getting all the summer crops in and while you're harvesting the spring crops. And then all the weeds start trying to come into it. And so there's a lot of weeding and cultivation. And then this time of year now, the harvest is going to start to take more and more of our time. We try to get all this harvesting done before 9, before it heats up, get it out of the field, get it in where it can stay cool. And that way it keeps the best. Get everything in good conditions, as best conditions we can.
What about insects?
Well, you know, insects always come when there's an unhealthy condition, really, and they come to eliminate the plants that aren't growing as strongly or are as healthy. So if you can try to build your overall fertility so you have really good soil fertility, and it's a balanced fertility, it's not like stimulated by a lot of fast-release, even organic fertilizers, you'll get big growth and everything, but you will unbalance the plant a little and you will have more insect problems. So for us, we, you know, do a lot of cover cropping on the soil, and we also create all of our compost out of this farm. So the materials, the manure from our livestock and the straw from fields, like a grain field will make straw or old hay, and then all of the green weed material, or if we have a clover or something we can cut and put in the compost, or a cover crop we can cut and put in the compost. Those three things, the manure, the straw, and the green material in thin layers and with about 10% soil. And we can create a really good compost. And then we use the biodynamic compost preparations, which there are 5, oak bark, dandelion, chamomile, yarrow, stinging nettle, valerian. And we insert those in the compost pile as it's reaching maturity, or, you know, starting to go into the fermentation. And those preparations help guide that whole breakdown of material in a real optimum way, that then it's already prepared and in a good balance and in a living state to go back into the soil as compost. So we generate about 40 or 50 tons of compost each year here. And we don't buy compost off the farm. I mean, it's actually a huge carbon footprint loss or release of carbon if you buy your compost from outside sources and all the material has been hauled in to make the compost. That's a big you know, pollution, energy footprint, and then, you know, it has to be turned mechanically, and then it's got to be loaded in a truck and taken back out to the farm, and that results in a really big carbon footprint for that farm. So we're trying to avoid that and create the compost right in the farm organism, and then it's just used right in the farm organism, so it's not being hauled. And we have better compost. We know what the material is that we've put in, and I think that that results in a better soil fertility, and that helps with the whole insect problem. So it's all connected. The farm is an organism. It's a living being in a way, and it needs all of its parts. If it just has nothing but vegetables and no livestock, or it just has nothing but livestock and no forage or plant material, then it's already starting in an unbalanced state. I mean, nature has the whole realm, you know, of plants and animals, and they're actually working together. And it's subtle relationships and mutual support, but ultimately it makes really a big difference to the health of the whole organism to create your inputs out of your farm. And that's, you know, a biodynamic principle, and we are a biodynamic farm, Demeter certified, for, gosh, since 1986, actually.
Demeter certification is a base set of standards that form a common legal foundation and agricultural framework for biodynamic practice worldwide.
So one of the basic principles of biodynamic farming is to try to create all that's needed for the farm out of the farm organism itself. So that's our goal. It's not always easy to achieve.
What are the challenges that you have to face?
Well, it's a lot of work to get all of that done. You know, like two or three mornings of the week, we have to go in the corral, pick up the manure from the animals that they leave overnight, and, you know, take it and build the compost. And there's just a lot to do, and so it's not that it's hard particularly to do, it's just that you really have to be aware of the timing and that you have a limited window. Everything has its time and its place in the order of things, and if you can stay abreast of that, then you can do a really good job. And if you don't respond and let stuff start slipping by, then it kind of avalanches and your weeds will take over your crops, and then you lose all the work that you've put in the first place to get the things raised and planted and started. And so it's the timing is really critical, and observation and being able to see what's coming. You know, you're always planning 6 months ahead of where you are, really. Like we're planting a lot of the fall crops actually are already planted now. You know, you can't just get one part planted and then sort of take a nap.
Oh, I thought there was a break in there somewhere.
Yeah, maybe a little bit in the winter, the days are a lot shorter. And but during the growing season, you know, there's a adage, make hay when the sun shines. Well, that's because the hay has to get dried, and, you know, it'll get damaged if it's rained on and everything. But it isn't just hay that is a crop that's sensitive to timing and to what's going on with nature. And it's really the same for everything. So, you know, you got to plant things when it's time, and you've got to weed when it's time, and you've got to harvest when it's time, or you're going to be off the track and not have very good results.
This climate and ecosystem just seems particularly suitable for farming in mm-hmm. Northern California, this region, and mm-hmm. I think of Utah and where it's so dry. And mm-hmm. what recommendations do you have for climates like that and to do this?
Yeah, well, vegetable growing in particular is a very water-intensive endeavor. There's just really no way around it. So I guess that means that you want to try to set aside some of the areas where there's good soil and where there is water, because those are the areas that are going to be critical for food production. And when we can't load it all in a truck and drive it 1,000 miles, it's going to be critical to have that ability. So those are probably the areas that are most attractive that people want to move into and live on. But really, we've got to, I think, preserve places where there's good soil and where there's good water. You know, people have succeeded. There's a story about, it's called The Man Who Planted Trees. It was in France, I believe, and it was an area that had been logged and destroyed more or less and was without water. And this guy spent a good part of his life just going through and planting chestnut trees and reforesting areas. And after a while, there started to be actually more water in springs coming back, you know. So that'd be a good public works project for the government. You know, spend some money there instead of blowing up places. And
the fracking, yeah. Right? And all the fracking that's going on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the water that's used for that is incredible volumes of water.
Right.
And then it gets polluted in the process. And so, I mean, it's the whole thing of a short-term win economically, a short-term win, and a long-term disaster. And my belief is that we will never really have sustainable agriculture until we have a sustainable economic process. And the market economic process based on gain for individual parties just is short-sighted in the end and will only lead to more and more conflict. And we need to change the economic process into an associative economic process where all the parties that are involved, their needs are looked at. And so in farming, that's going to be the earth, the farmer, and the eaters. Those are all players. And we have to look at those needs and then base the economics off of that, meeting those needs. Then we have a sustainable economic system. And the bottom line is meeting the common good, not meeting individual profit. And that's where we got to go, because the population, human population, just increases. The Earth's resources are finite. Survival in the future is going to be survival of the whole community, of all of us, not just individual factions. And so we could do that. This farm is specifically, we have chosen not to engage in the conventional market process. We don't sell food in any farmers markets. We don't sell food to retail or wholesale. We work directly with a community of members, of people that know the farm and are willing to defray the operating costs and share a little bit of the risk of the season. So far, there's never been a food failure of any extent that people would end up having to go hungry, except maybe a couple of times with late spring frosts in the spring that have delayed the ripening and the planting and then subsequent harvest. There are storage crops that you can bridge some of those less fruitful times with. You know, we've kept potatoes and onions clear through March, and cabbage, and some of the kale and chard and some of those kinds of greens that are almost biennial that you can stretch through a couple of seasons, you can still harvest food from. So, you know, the members do share a little bit in risk, but really, we're all going to share in the risks of life.
Stephen says they have not had any severe shortages in the 23 years they have been supplying food.
It's been a pretty bountiful food supply. But this plant has too many fruits.
The clean, pine-like scent of parsley permeates my nostrils as I kneel down to talk to Sylvia from Canada. She hopes to start her own small organic farm and does not mind the hard work. They work from dawn until 7 p.m. Monday through Friday and half a day on Saturday. She sees the value in this kind of farm work.
I think that it's showing a way of being that is sustainable in a lot of different ways. I like the economic model that they have, and I like the way that we use our own farm to produce the fertility that we need for the garden. I think that's important in a lot of organic places, just buy compost. That might be me. I might do that in the future, but I want to know how to make my own. It's a lot of work, but I think it's worth it. I think it's nice to have the kids come to the farm too.
It is around 9 in the morning, and Sarah and Keegan are nearly finished with the corn harvest. It's breakfast time, and they are anxious to finish and make their way to the communal kitchen.
And so you must eat really well here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's a perk I should have mentioned.
What are your meals like?
Oh, they're amazing. Honestly, every meal is fantastic, and we cook for one another. We have a big enough farm crew here that we trade off preparing lunch and dinner for each other, and breakfast as well. It's a little bit less formal, but we all cook for each other, and it's a great gift. Mm-hmm. And I think everyone really enjoys preparing meals for their coworkers, so that when the rest of us come in hungry and tired, there's a really amazing meal waiting for us. Mm-hmm. And I don't think people would work as hard as they do here if the food weren't so good, because that's a big part of our compensation.
Yeah.
So everyone who works here, that's something that they really value in their lives, is good food and
a healthy diet, right?
When we go out to the sort in Mendocino, or when there are a couple times we went to San Francisco together, and people always comment on how healthy we look. I mean, we think we look pretty dirty because, you know, we have permadirt all in our hands. But, yeah, people usually comment on how vibrant we look. And, it's the lifestyle, it's the food.
Mind if I record your kitchen sounds for a few minutes?
No,
that's what it's all about, right?
They want beans, warming up some.
Utah has its own growing CSA community. There are about 35, and a few of them practice biodynamic principles. More information is available at csautah.org.
Waste not. Run your clothes washer and dishwasher only when they are full. You can save up to 1,000 gallons a month.
Waste Not is made possible by the Logan City Public Works Water Conservation Department. Information at loganutah.org/publicworks.
Utah Public Radio presents StoryCorps, an oral history project in conjunction with the National Library of Congress, recorded in May of 2013 in St. George. 31-year-old Janine Donald is the director of Splore, a nonprofit organization that provides outdoor adventures for people of all abilities. At StoryCorps, she asked her friend and mentor, Martha Hamm, about founding Splore in 1977 when Martha was 26 years old.
I was about your age when I started Splore. I wasn't a visionary. This was something that began kind of like a chain letter. And the minute I sent out 10 chain letters, 10 people showed up. The first trip we ran for persons with disabilities, I was so scared. I was so frightened we were going to hurt somebody, kill somebody. The people who came on the trip were in wheelchairs, a lot of the folks had cerebral palsy. The staff got to Moab and drove the road along the river, and it was like a cartoon. The driver just drove like a bat out of hell. And all these disabled people were in there saying, "Whee!" You know, and I was so scared. I thought the bus was going to go off the road. And I thought, well, my goodness, the river trip is going to look pretty tame next to this. But we were all ready to treat them like porcelain. You know, because you have to keep in mind Public Law 94-142 that just allowed people with disabilities to go to public school had passed not that many years earlier. And then American Disabilities Act had not passed. So the public really had not had much exposure to people with disabilities. So we were all very inexperienced.
So you were learning together. They were learning the rivers, and you were learning how to interact and work with folks with very different life experiences.
And I think that's what we really wanted to do in the beginning, is not just make the wilderness accessible to people with disabilities, but find a way that they could participate. Maybe they weren't going to row a boat, but they're going to flip the pancakes and make breakfast.
And how long did it take until you've got a sense of that spirit, that magic that we talk about at Splore?
The story I'm thinking of occurred many years after I left Splore, and I had taken a job going into nursing homes and assessing people with disabilities to determine whether they could live outside the nursing home. So I'm interviewing this woman who was in a chair, and the only way she could move was with one foot. She couldn't really use her hands, and she would move that wheelchair with one foot. So I asked her, "What is your hobby? What are your leisure interests?" And she looked at me and she said, "River running." And she took that foot and she did this 360 and came around and put her face right in my face. And she said, "I go with Splore." And what was so wonderful to me was this person who was so disabled, she described herself as a river runner.
We see so many people on Splore who our inspiration to continue to tap into that well of courage where you just go for something. You don't know how it's going to turn out. And that has definitely inspired me to do things that don't come easily, and that it's okay. It's okay to have to ask for help.
Well, I wanted you to know how I have been so impressed with how you handle yourself as Splore's director, and you remind me so much of what our community was like in the early days.
I am so thankful that you sent out that chain letter, because that idea is truly still changing lives, and Splore feels like family.
These interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Utah Public Radio. Support for StoryCorps on Utah Public Radio comes from Dixie Regional Medical Center, located on two campuses in St. George, serving northwestern Arizona, southeastern Nevada, and southern Utah. Information at dixieregional.org.
This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KCEU 89.7 Price, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.